This is ARRL's Eclectic Tech, a bi-weekly look at the technical and scientific side of amateur radio with your host Steve Ford, WB8IMY. Eclectic Tech is brought to you by ICOM. ICOM, for the love of ham radio, is about the passion for an incredible hobby. Visit ICOM in the community webpage at www.icomamerica.com/community.
Amateur radio faces many threats in the 21st century, and among the worst is the inexorable increase in noise. If you tune through the HF band, you'll often hear noise, and lots of it. Now, if you're blessed with living out in the country, it may not be too bad, but for those of us who dwell elsewhere, it can sometimes be serious. Listen to this. What you've just heard is noise on 20 meters at my station. I have no idea what's causing it, but I intend to go out and see if I can find it. And this is just one example. When someone in my household is washing clothes, I can hear the swish, swish, swish on my radio on every band from 40 meters all the way through 10 meters. The International Amateur Radio Union recently did a study that confirmed what all of us really knew, which was that all of these varieties of noise are increasing every single day, and they're making it more difficult for hams to operate. It is having an impact on other radio services as well. So what can we do about it? Well, the knee-jerk response is to say the FCC should be taking care of this, since many consumer electronic devices are emitting signals that are clearly illegal, right? However, today's grossly underfunded FCC can barely perform its core responsibilities. It has been demonstrated in many instances that the FCC is not going to enforce rules against noisy devices encountered by individual hams. The only time the FCC gets involved is when noise interference becomes an issue for a large user or a large service, let's say. For example, let's say that a noise source suddenly appears and causes severe interference to the local police department repeater network. The FCC will get involved in that instance pretty quickly because it's a public safety issue. But when it comes to the interference woes of amateur radio operators, the FCC just doesn't have the time or the resources to investigate. So what's next? Well, the obvious answer is that you have to take care of it yourself. And one of the best tools is an inexpensive handheld shortwave receiver. I have a pocket-sized model that I keep around the shack here, and I consider it to be a pretty valuable tool. Now, you might think I go walking around my neighborhood with this thing, trying to find where noise sources are coming from, and that's not actually true, although it does occur to me from time to time. The first step, really, is to make sure that the noise is not coming from in or around your house. The easiest way to do that is to tune in the noise with the handheld receiver and then take the receiver to your circuit breaker panel. Presumably, you can still hear it there, of course. As you're listening to the noise, start flipping off the circuit breakers one after another after another. What may happen is that if you're lucky, you may flip one of those breakers and the noise will suddenly stop. If it does, you've at least partially located the source of the noise. Let's say you look at the breaker and you see that the circuit controls power to, well, I don't know, the master bedroom. Turn that breaker back on. If the noise returns, you're on the right track. You make a beeline for the bedroom with your radio. You can move the radio about the room and see if the signal becomes stronger, or just sit the radio somewhere and play around and see what happens. By play around, I mean, of course, start unplugging things. You'll eventually pull the plug on your culprit, and the noise will suddenly vanish. Of course, the job isn't over yet. Do you just throw away the offending device? Well, that probably isn't very practical. In all likelihood, you're going to have to move to the next phase, which is attempting to cure the problem. You might try getting a Type 43 ferrite core and wrapping about 10 turns of the power cord through it. That usually kills the noise completely, or at least reduces it substantially. All of this assumes, however, that the noise is inside your home or inside your apartment, as the case may be. It could be coming from the neighbor's home. If that's the case, at least in my experience, the problem becomes more difficult by orders of magnitude, because now you have another human being involved. If you don't know your neighbor well, or worse, you're on bad terms, it's pretty unlikely that that person's going to allow you to come in their house and try to find the noise source. Can you imagine inviting this ham radio operator that you don't know very well to come into your home and go down to your circuit panel box and just start flipping breakers while listening to a radio he's carrying around? I don't think so. Most normal folks wouldn't be very welcoming of that sort of thing. Now, some people say that this is the time when you should get a hold of your FCC office and send the feds after them. Well, good luck with that. At ARRL, our experience in recent years has been that the FCC is extremely reluctant to become involved in these things. So what do? Do you just give up? Rather than give up, I prefer to use the word accommodate. And by that, I mean try to find a way to work around the problem. If the offending noise is at a specific frequency, perhaps you can just avoid that frequency, as irritating as that may be. If it's a wideband form of interference throughout the entire HF band, your options are obviously much more limited. There are devices out there, I know in fact MFJ makes one, that act as separate, what you might call diversity receivers. They essentially feed the local noise back out of phase in an attempt to cancel it. Now, these can be very effective, but they require a certain amount of adjustment and sometimes readjustment every time you change frequencies. In other words, they're kind of a pain to use, or at least they can be. When they work very well, and they can reduce broadband noise to an acceptable level. Another, and perhaps easier way to accommodate, is to reduce your RF sensitivity. Most transceivers have an RF gain control, especially HF transceivers. Some transceivers also include a push-button attenuator. These are neglected controls, but they can have a world of benefit. I'll give you a personal example. In fact, I'll let you hear it. At my station, I have a broadband noise that I can hear from roughly 40 meters up through about 15 meters. It's particularly strong on 30 and 20 meters. I can't determine where it's coming from, but I'm fairly certain that it's somewhere in the local neighborhood. The strength of the noise varies, and on particularly bad days, it can rise to about S4. Here's what it sounds like. This noise is fairly constant, and it's present around the clock. One of these days, I'll track it down, but until then, well, I just toggle my attenuator button. Here's the noise again, and you'll know the moment that I switch in the attenuator. Ah, sweet relief. Yes, I made my transceiver a bit deaf, but I can still hear plenty of signals. In fact, with the noise reduced, I can actually hear somewhat more than I did before. ARRL and the International Amateur Radio Union are continuing to fight this battle against increasing noise. As we come up with new and novel ways of dealing with noise, you'll see the articles popping up in QST and QEX magazine. It's also worthwhile to visit the ARRL Laboratory page on the web at www.arrl.org. They have samples of specific types of noise you can hear that will help you identify the problem. So at the end of the day, you either find the noise source in your home, and if you're lucky, you can eliminate it. If the noise sources are outside your home, maybe you'll be lucky enough to have an extremely friendly and cooperative neighbor, in which case he'll allow you to play Sherlock Holmes in his house. These people are called unicorns, by the way. I forgot to mention that power lines can often be powerful noise sources. If you can track it down to a particular pole, the utility company may want to hear from you. If there is electrical arcing taking place, they want to fix that problem before it turns into something much worse. I'm on the telephone with David Hodge, N6AN. Good afternoon, David.
Good afternoon, Steve. Nice to speak to you, not on the radio.
And David, you are at Caltech. What's your title there?
My title is research engineer. I consider myself more of a good hand-eye coordination guy rather than a brain. I think there are plenty of really, really powerful brains on campus, so I don't try to fit into that category.
Are you the only amateur radio operator in your specific area?
No. Well, what's interesting about my specific area at the moment, I have been working at Caltech for about 3 years. I worked for Caltech a long, long time ago, sort of my first career from 77 to 87 in the biology electronics shop, building experimental test equipment for neurobiology. But I've been working with a radio astronomer named Sandy Weinreb, who is responsible for the receiver, the electronics that gets a fast radio burst signal, which is what we're looking for.
Oh, those have been very much in the science news lately, yes.
Yeah, the sub-millisecond to a few millisecond long intense bursts of energy. We're trying to figure out where they're coming from. And so I've been working with Sandy, building electronics, learning from scratch to do what I've been doing. I'm one ham with Sandy. There are some other hams, I think, in the astronomy department at Caltech. There are certainly other hams on campus. Sometimes it's hard to know who's a ham and who isn't because we're not necessarily in a cohesive group or club. So there are probably more hams on campus than I'm aware.
Well, not to put you on the spot, David, but can you elaborate a little bit from a layman's perspective on what a fast radio burst actually is?
Well, I did a little research myself just to make sure that I wasn't out in the weeds. They're generally extragalactic. They're, as I said, sub-millisecond to a few milliseconds. So they're very fast bursts. They're rather intense. I read, I think, on the wiki site that a cell phone on the moon on Earth is maybe sort of an equivalent of energy level. As somebody else wrote, they rival the brightest radio sky sources in flux density. If you're looking in the right place, it's like somebody flashed a super bright LED light at you from, you know, down the street, or maybe even a laser, although I don't think it's not, you know, collimated like a laser. We've been looking for them in the, and I say we with a, I'm one of the spokes and one of the wheels. We've been building equipment that's working in the 1280 to 1530 megahertz range. So it's 1.2 to 1.5 gigahertz. One of the graduate students who's involved in this greater group has three dishes, the electronics of which I built by hand, incidentally. And one of his little array is almost, not to put it down, but in comparison, a toy array, saw this most recent radio burst in, I think it was end of April, straight on. And so he's made what might be considered a pretty big discovery. So I think he's assured his PhD, which makes me very happy.
When you call it a toy array, physically, about how big is it?
Well, we're talking three, I guess you could say, you know, the equivalent of a satellite dish that's, say, 4 meters across. And the feed point is I can't remember exact dimensions, but it's maybe 5 or 6 inches across. It's an aluminum cylinder that has been welded. There's a back plate that's been welded to it and a couple of honest to God cake pans. And I forget the manufacturer of them, but aluminum cake pans with, you know, vertical walls where it's been rolled down for, you know, it looks nice and it won't cut you. One of those inside another put on the back, which I think helps with something called, I can't remember. I don't know much about the telescope functioning. But that telescope, that cylinder has two probes. So you've got two probes at 90 degrees to get vertical and horizontal polarization, essentially, or two different polarizations. And at those probes is a low noise amplifier. The first version was actually designed with a G8, I forget his suffix, but a amateur radio product as a low noise amplifier. And then that goes into two boxes. One is known as the front end board, which filters the incoming RF and then converts it to a light signal. So through fiber optic cable, it can go, you know, 500 feet or a couple of kilometers, depending on where the antenna is in an array. Because the idea is to make Chris Botchnik has three telescopes in his simple array to find this thing in April. Our original proposal was a 10 array. It's called the Deep Synoptic Array of 10 antennas. And we're building now the 110 antenna version. So from the front end box, you have the signals going back to a back end box and the communication is through fiber optic. The back end box converts the light back to RF, and it's mixed down to a pass band, which has the information in which it corresponds to the 1280 to 1530 megahertz bandwidth. And then that's put into digital signal processing using GPUs or big servers. They're made by NVIDIA, I think. And then there's a special software that somebody's written that will sift through all of this stuff. I mean, to me, it's like looking for a needle in a really, really big haystack. I mean, basically, you're looking after the fact for the right shape, pulse of the right, and, you know, the right parameters. That is an indication of a signal. I think what they're hoping is that they can program it so that the detection will happen within 60 seconds of the event being received at the antennas, so that a network of people around the world can know that this detection has happened. And one of the advantages of knowing about the detections right away is that other, I don't know how much optical comes into this, but other satellites or detection devices can look at different wavelengths, whether it's X-ray or what have you, and tell a lot about, is there a correlation between what's happening in the X-ray spectrum or some other part of the electromagnetic spectrum? Does that correlate with the signal that, that is supposedly this FRB detection? So it's amazing what is going on. And I knew nothing about radio astronomy other than the fact that it existed 3 years ago. So this has been, I don't know, it feels like if you could peel my brain away and pour the information, then that might have been an easier way to, but it's been an incredible experience to be part of this.
And what, you mentioned the front end, the back end components. What parts are you particularly involved in, either designing, building, or both?
Design, I've had nothing to do with. Sandy's really the designer. He's had help from a couple of graduate students, one who is now a postdoc. But I've done a lot of the, somebody will hand me a PC board that was designed. The first ones of these, in fact, I think the ones that Chris is using for his three antenna array, I built those boards by hand. So I was using tweezers and a microscope to pick up, 0402, 0603 components, depending on the size, and, placing them on a board, not using a wave soldering machine, but a hot plate to solder them, and then, build them into a box, and then make sure the box was working.
As weak as these bursts are, it's phenomenal that you're able to detect them at all.
Well, Sandy has designed low noise amplifiers for a long time. That's one of his specialties. And there's another thing that I had never done before, handling discrete chip transistors. A lot of hams have touched transistors before, but they're usually the kind that are in a can with three leads, or these days it would be a surface mount, might even be a combination pack of transistors, but it would have at least three leads. Well, this chip is, say, 300 by 300 by 100 microns, and I have to pick that up with a pair of tweezers and use conductive epoxy to put it on a PC board in the right place. I have to wire bond the, in this case, it's, I think they're HEMPT, H-E-M-P-T transistors, if I got that right. But it's a gate, drain, and source that need to be connected in the circuit. So that was all new to me.
You must have phenomenal eyesight, or you have visual assistance of some kind.
Oh, this is all done under a microscope. I mean, certainly,
I was going to say.
Yeah, wire bonders have this particular one has a mouse pad. Basically, you put the thing you want to wire bond, you have to put that on a platform, and the mouse allows you to move this platform around under the microscope, which is aligned with the tip of this wedge bonding machine. And when you get the alignment right, you bring the wedge bonder down to the surface where you want that bond to be made, and then the machine will produce the bond for you. And then you have to spool the wire out and bring it down to the next point where you'll make the second bond. And that just takes a little hand-eye coordination and some knowledge of what's what.
This takes homebrewing to a whole new level, I would say.
We talked about I'm set up to do a lot of my work now in-house, in home, rather. We talked about bringing a wire bonder over here and decided that was probably not a good idea. It's been quite an adventure. And to have the original 10 antennas are in place and have been working, and they detected something in, I think it was announced in July of 2019. And then to have something that I have my fingerprints in discover this thing in April of this year for Chris is pretty cool.
And something that is entirely mysterious still, as you say, extragalactic, but as I understand it, what is causing it is not entirely known.
This is true. And I think one of the, there's apparently one aspect of fast radio bursts that can help determine what sort of source it's emanating from. And that has to do with its polarity. And from what I read, the polarity, if a signal has a strong polarity, that's an indication that it's coming from an extremely, these are this writer's words, extremely strong magnetic field, a source with an extremely strong magnetic field. I'd never heard of a magnetar.
Magnetar, yes.
Magnetars, apparently this particular detection of Chris's in April is coming from a celestial object that has I had it on my screen here earlier, but it you know, however they designated these things, you know, XYZG-1427 or something like that. It's got some designator like that, and they suspect that that is a magnetar. So the result of that discovery is there's a very good chance, yeah, SGR-1935+2154.
Aha.
And I guess if I did more of this, I'd have that memorized. They suspect that this may very well indicate that at least in our galaxy, because I think this is in the galaxy, that is a good indication that, you know, we found a magnet. Well, we know that this particular FRB comes from a magnetar. As somebody said, I wouldn't say it's the nail in the coffin that we've figured out that fast radio bursts come from magnetars. This is Emily Petroff, an astronomer at University of Amsterdam in Netherlands. But it's by far the most promising piece of evidence that we've found. So there are other theories, and they range from some extraterrestrial intelligence source to, say, a supermassive black hole or an older neutron star. And I'm not sure I can elaborate on what those things are.
Well, I doubt that many people in our audience even realized, until today perhaps, that amateur radio operators were involved at this level of cutting-edge research.
It's, I think, you know, Palomar Observatory, one of the guys working there for a long time, is now back at Caltech on campus. So I think as our amateur radio interests are so varied, it's amazing to find what the ham and what the professional in the same body are doing.
Oh, yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I was always mystified by the fact that there was such a thing as radio astronomy, that there were signals that somehow people are, I mean, you turn your receiver around, what are you listening for? And this has just opened up this whole, how this works. It's just amazing to me what radio astronomers have learned by studying electromagnetic energy coming from off the planet.
Well, thank you, David. I appreciate it.
Oh, well, my pleasure. Thank you, Steve.
Tune in again for the next episode of Eclectic Tech, produced by ARRL, the National Association for Amateur Radio. Music is provided by Purple Planet at purpleplanet.com. If you have comments, email eclectic@arrl.org. This episode is copyright ARRL, and all rights are reserved. I'm Sabrina Jackson, KC1JMW. See you next time.